We're Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
If the PRO Act were already law, Amazon wouldn't have been able to resort to its dirty anti-union tricks to defeat the Bessemer, Alabama warehouse workers' union drive. Well, at least for now, that is.
As the RWDSU is forced now to challenge Amazon's roadblocks to its unionization drive at Amazon's Bessemer, Alabama warehouse, we speak with Brandon Magner.
Brandon Magner is a labor lawyer who writes about unions and the law at Substack, Labor Law Lite, and he can't help but think how different the outcome would be if protecting the right to organize, the PRO Act, was the law.
48% of all non-union workers surveyed say they would vote for a union if given the opportunity, a roughly 50% higher share than when a similar survey was taken some 40 years earlier. And the 65% of Americans who approve of labor unions is higher than it has been since the early 2000s, with young workers the most supportive. But the share of workers represented by a union was just 12.1% in 2020. How are we to understand that equation? And thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Something that distinguishes the U.S. from pretty much every other industrialized country in the world is that our labor law makes it very hard to unionize. No other country in the world has a labor code in which the employer basically has an equal say with the union in terms of the formation and the composition of the bargaining unit. We saw that with Amazon, how that was a really big deal early on in terms of what the size of the unit was, who got to be in the unit, and what kind of say the employer got at the pre-election proceedings. More importantly, the employer in the U.S. gets an incredibly broad power to campaign against the union under free speech justifications in our law. These things have been mastered by employers over the last 40 years. What we've seen is basically a foolproof playbook plan that they play in every election. They do it because it's extremely successful. Unions have not been able to come up with a response to this under our present laws that can defeat it. There's also other things at play, whether it's automation, just general economic forces, convincing people to try and be atomistic, to be individualistic, to not unite. But I think all these forces interplay with each other. I can confidently say that we have an incredibly anti-worker labor law, suffocating workers now for 85 years.
In terms of the labor law itself and the Amazon campaign, and we're also trying to put it in the context of the PRO Act, which is in Congress right now, to reform the labor law. Why don't we start with some of these things that you mentioned in detail, what Amazon is doing and how it's working now and how it would be reformed by the PRO Act. The first I would mention would be the composition of the bargaining unit. Who is going to be in the union if the union wins?
One thing that's been in the law since it was first passed in 1935 is that employers have what's called standing to participate in pre-election proceedings. That standing is what gives them a right to be there, to make their objections to whatever the union files, to say, we believe the unit should look like this because these workers should be bargaining or these workers shouldn't be bargaining. That's incredibly unique to just the United States Labor Code or really any other organization that is ever formed by the people who want to form it. You think about everything from a trade group to a glee club, whatever. It's usually the members are the ones who get to decide what it looks like. And under the PRO Act, that's basically how it would be. In the Amazon situation, they were able to take the union's original petition of around 1,500 workers to say, no, it should be every worker who works in the plant. And so they were basically able, and the NLRB agreed, and they were able to inflate the size. And I should be clear that the NLRB was constricted by Trump board rulings in recent years that have hamstrung them from being able to challenge employers when employers want what's called a wall-to-wall unit. But they were able to inflate the unit basically almost quadrupled in size, and that, of course, makes it much harder and requires more resources to organize. So the union, under the PRO Act, it would remove...
Before we get to PRO Act, which we haven't even described, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know what it is, I just want to go back for a moment. The answer to the first question and what Ken was asking you dovetailed into the issue of labor law. I wonder if you can talk about and parse out a little bit more about the current labor laws, which are supposed to protect the right of workers in the private sector to organize. Clearly that hasn't happened. Why not?
The law was originally passed with the assumption that there would eventually be two good faith parties to every election who are willing to accept the results or who are willing to fairly give their opinion and their message about what unionization should be, and that the workers would then decide based upon this political analogy that's present throughout our labor law of industrial democracy, of this is the equivalent of a political election within the workplace. The problem is that this analogy is just completely falls apart when you compare it to any actual political election. Well, how the election works under the NLRA in America would be the equivalent of if Donald Trump was allowed to take every voter in the country, stick them in a room, only talk to them, while Joe Biden had to wait outside the door hoping that they saw his message on a pamphlet or something. Meanwhile, Trump got to say anything he wanted about the union or about Biden, and the election took place over the course of 6 months. The problem with the NLRA is that employers have found that it is very
easy to break the law. And that's the National Labor Relations Act.
Yeah. Yes, the National Labor Relations Act. The employers have found that under the National Labor Relations Act, there's very few actual disincentives to stop them from breaking the law. The law being things like you can't promise certain things about the union. You can't say that the union will lose jobs or that they'll close the workplace, things like that. Because there is no provision in the NLRA for monetary remedies or fines, like tons of other federal laws that will fine you for breaking them. The NLRA has no fine. It only has what's called a notice posting remedy, which says if you break the law, then they'll put up a small foot-by-foot poster that says we broke the law and we're sorry. That doesn't go a long way in teaching workers that you won't threaten their livelihood for supporting the union. Usually the worst-case scenario in an election for an employer is that the election results may be set aside for your violations, but this is a far cry from something that would actually have some force, like a bargaining order, which would force the employer to actually bargain with the union and certify the union. Basically, all that a rerun election does in most contexts is it allows the employer another shot at beating out what's already a broken down union that's probably had some turnover in the bargaining unit. And it gets to say, all right, I get another crack at this. And you guys, we can do this for years because we're going to appeal this and we're going to appeal this to the federal courts. There's nothing that's going to stop us. And there's no monetary remedy that's going to really sway us or change our calculus about how we're going to conduct business here. So the NLRA is basically, it's a failed system of trying to bring two parties together to at least play fair when one side has all the power originally, and there's nothing in the law that really stops the employer from exercising that power or even going beyond it in legal means.
Now, just to flesh out the employer's free speech rights on the job with regard to the elections, tell us more about one-on-one meetings, captive audience meetings, the amount of signs they can post, the website, things of that nature that they can use to intimidate the workers.
Under the NLRA, employers have what's called a free speech right, which is so long as they don't threaten, coerce, or intimidate, or interfere with the election, they have the right to say what they want, which is interpreted to mean they can say, I don't like the union and the union won't be good for you. But you can't go so far as to say, I can guarantee you that the union won't be good for you because I'm going to close the plant, things like that. So there's usually a pretty clear line, and that line is usually overstepped for the reasons I've described about the lack of penalties that are in the law. But part of what the free speech right is interpreted to give the employers is the right to a captive audience meeting. An employer will gather all of the workers or a subset of workers into a room, usually for an hour or more. They get to present their side, which is, we don't like unions, we think unions are bad, and here's why. And the more important than the specific words that the employer is saying is usually the context of what the employee is receiving, is that I am locked here in a room, there's nothing I can do about it, I can't leave, this is a mandatory meeting, and the employer is able to exercise its will over me to keep me here and listen to this message. You learn that it's either swayed a lot of people who are on the fence or it's convinced people who may have thought about joining the union that now it's a huge, it's almost like a rebellion against the employer to be for the union. That's something that really effectively intimidates people in the bargaining unit. For 70 years now, the law has said that that's okay, but the PRO Act would make that an unfair law.
Help us understand a little bit more about why these what are called captive meetings are so intimidating.
They're intimidating, I think, because of more so, like I said, than any specific message that they're giving. It's the context of the employer has all the power. It's the one that controls your wages, your work schedule, your benefits. They can change that at will. If you don't have a union, if you don't have a collective bargaining agreement with a just cause provision, you are an at-will worker. And you have some protections under the law, and you're asking about what's a standard. A clear standard is you can't fire somebody for organizing a union if you're firing them because of an anti-union animus. That's been understood in the law for 80 years at this point. But employers will often break it because the reward, which is often intimidating or crushing a organizing drive, is a lot greater than the punishment, which is the obligation to pay back pay to that worker for firing them. But the NLRA does not have any provisions for punitive remedies. You can't double the amount just because as a punishment to the employer. It is purely a remedial framework in which you only are obligated to pay for what you did in the past. So most lawyers and most organizers and these parties to the election understand where the lines are. The problem is the employer will often overstep it. There's really very little punishment for them for overstepping that boundary. To them, it is simply more advantageous to break the law by saying, I'm going to close the plant, because that may convince more workers to not support the union than it would convince them, oh, he's willing to break the law. I don't want to be seen supporting somebody like that.
We're speaking with Brendan Magno, labor lawyer, about the PRO Act. What are some of the specific things, if you could just elaborate on that more, that Amazon did that was so frightening to workers that have resulted in what I dare say will be filings of unfair labor practices, but most immediately have caused the union vote, a pro vote, not to prevail. What did they do?
I think number one, it always starts with the captive audience meetings, just in the sense of those are legal, but I think they explain a lot of why the union lost a lot of support, because studies show that they're used in over 90% of union election now by the employer. The reason why they're used so often is because they have to be effective. When they're able to get out their message every day, the message that they want to the workers they want to, and the union has no equal say or equal right in being able to disseminate its message, you're just getting a clear misbalance of information. And we see that play out, in the political context when people are fed one message and without the ability to hear a response, there a lot of them will begin to believe what they're hearing from the one party and are not going to take it upon themselves to go personally and double check that. But there's also the issues of, it seems clear now, is that Amazon defied the National Labor Relations Board order not to place their own ballot box around the workplace. It was a mail ballot election, so the way workers were voting over the last 2 months was by mail instead of the usual system of showing up to the workplace and casting a ballot during the workday. It is unlawful for either of the parties to interfere with the handling of any ballots. That's supposed to be something only the National Labor Relations Board is supposed to be the one, postal service, is supposed to be the ones collecting those ballots. And what Amazon is accused of right now is requesting or coercing the postal service to install their own personal mail ballot box for workers to drop their ballots in. And if Amazon was able to exercise any sort of control over that ballot box, I think that is more than enough to set aside an election and constitute an unfair labor practice. What it does show is that it likely intimidated a lot of workers that, oh, I need to send my ballot here. Otherwise, the employers, if they don't see me sending my ballot here, then they're going to think, oh, he must be a union. So they may be on the fence, or they may be a soft union supporter that is not confident enough yet to be out and out in the workplace yet, and because they think it'll subject themselves to retaliation. That's another one of like the displays of power that the employer can use to convince people that I'm the one calling the shots here. The overall coercive atmosphere at play here that the union's going to try and claim that not only was coercive in itself, but also heightened the tensions of whatever other moves that were being made by the employer in this election. And they're going to ask the NLRB to set aside the election on those grounds.
What would be the amount of trespassing by Amazon on the rights of workers in the election that would constitute the NLRB setting aside the election? What would that mean?
Usually an unfair labor practice, unless it's determined to be de minimis, such as one supervisor telling one worker something that may have crossed the line, such as suggesting plant closure, that may be determined. If it's in a 1,000-person voter list, then they might determine that that wasn't enough to overturn an election, assuming that the union didn't lose by one vote. But if these are widespread interferences, such as interferences with ballot boxes, communications that were disseminated by text message that contained an unlawful threat or something similar, then the labor board will often say that they are unable to tell which workers were intimidated, so they'll just set aside the election because they're unable to tell. So it's usually a pretty strict standard, and most unfair labor practices are enough to upset. But it can also be things that weren't necessarily unfair labor practices in and of themselves, but were statements of traditionally coercive natures when combined, say, a de minimis unfair labor practices, were enough to be worthy of setting aside the election. So it's a pretty strict standard. You will often see if there's things that can be credibly called unfair labor practices, then the election will often be set aside. And I don't want to be making a prediction necessarily, but I think there's a very good chance that the election result will be set aside.
The National Labor Relations Act is supposed to protect the rights of private sector workers to organize. It doesn't. The shortcomings are manifest. And then there's the operations of the National Labor Relations Board, which was established to carry out the key parts of the law. And we understand the political weaknesses there that are exploited by anti-union employers. So talk about now, which Ken had asked you about earlier, really, the protecting the right to organize, now popularly become known as the PRO Act. Where did that come from, and what is it such that it would remedy some of the terrible things that you described that make it so hard to win a union election against a monster, giant behemoth such as Amazon?
So the Protecting the Right to Organize Act is sort of the latest addition in labor law reform. The PRO Act is far more comprehensive and goes far further than any previous. So just speaking and trying to use the Amazon election as an example, it creates unfair labor practices for things like captive audience meetings, for misclassification of workers, for the use of permanent replacements in an economic strike. But more importantly, I think, even than just creating a new set of unlawful activity, it actually allows the NLRB to impose monetary penalties up to $50,000 for each unfair labor practice. And this racks up pretty heavily when we're talking about mid-size and small-size employers, because a lot of them can commit more than one unfair labor practice in the course of an election or organizing drive or something similar. And that ability to actually impose penalties about employers will change that their current calculus of, oh, it's basically just a cost of business for us to fire a union supporter because all I have to do is just pay them what I would have owed them in the first place. It removes some restrictions on unions that have existed since the Taft-Hartley Act, such as the inability to use secondary boycotts or recognitional picketing. It allows them to use more creative and shorter strikes, like intermittent strikes, quickie strikes, slowdowns. It's basically, I think, the closest thing that unions can do to repealing Taft-Hartley and responding to the modern challenges under labor law than they've ever had. It comes much closer than the current law does to achieving what the NLRA was set out to do, which it says in its very first section of the law, it says in bold print, that it is the economic policy of the United States to encourage collective bargaining. And I think the PRO Act comes much closer than any previous attempt to actually achieving that.
If there are rampant infractions by the employer in the workers' organizing, is there a way to impose the first contract to recognize the union by the NLRB?
You get a first contract no matter what now under the law. If you organize a union and you're certified by the NLRB, then they say if you don't have a contract ratified with your employer within 90 days, you're allowed to refer your dispute to a set of neutral arbitrators who will mediate the dispute, and if it's still unable to be mediated, will create a collective bargaining agreement through that way. So no longer will the old method be in place where employers are allowed to, even if they lose the election, are allowed to try to bargain the death by stalling and trying to lose their support without ever getting a contract. Now that's out of the equation. You will get a first contract if you organize a union under the PRO Act.
To what extent would worker activists threatened with firing or being fired, would that fall under the PRO Act?
It is currently legal right now to threaten or fire a worker for an anti-union reason. But the PRO Act goes farther in terms of actually remedying this because it doesn't wait for you to get punished or fired. If you get terminated in the course of an election context, the NLRB is required under the PRO Act to seek an injunction in federal district court to get you your job back. So you're no longer waiting to get fired, and then you're waiting for the NLRB processes to play out, which can last years, for somebody to eventually determine that you get your job back, and then the employer goes through even more stalling of appealing that decision, and then finally, maybe 3 years later, they'll be forced to accept the result. The federal district court, if granting the injunction, which has a pretty low standard for granting it, will restore the status quo in the workplace very quickly. And that's important in the election context, because restoring a fired worker back to his job, you know, before the election is held, can be something that is, you know, a powerful symbolic gesture that the employer did something wrong and will not be able to get away with it. Why I say the PRO Act's pretty comprehensive.
Is there anything that's not in the PRO Act right now that you would like to be?
It overturns a 2002 Supreme Court case that said that undocumented workers, who, even if the employer is found to have committed unfair labor practices against them, say terminating them in the context of an election for union support, can't owe them back pay, because somehow the immigration laws conflict with the NLRA in the sense that doesn't allow undocumented workers to be allowed to be given any sort of back pay for violations that were committed. So the PRO Act would overturn that decision and say that undocumented workers are just like any other worker. If they're fired for supporting a union, then the law will allow them to actually get back pay. What I'm surprised by is that one of the original sins of the NLRA that most people criticize, it was a compromise with Southern Democrats at the time that domestic workers and farm workers were kept out of the law, in large part because those were the industries in which predominantly filled with minorities and female workers, people who employers didn't want organizing unions. The compromise on this decision to get the NLRA passed and get the Southern Democrats' support. I would have liked to see the PRO Act include them under the coverage of the PRO Act. To really remedy that wrong, you would have had to bring everybody back under the fold, and I would have liked to see that.
Once workers do vote to join a union, employers, of course, frequently continue using delay as a tactic. So I wonder if you can talk about how the PRO Act addresses that. And also, since we've been looking at Alabama, we've been looking at the Bessemer plant, Amazon workers, the PRO Act also repeals state right-to-work laws, which has weakened unions for decades.
The PRO Act installs a system of first contract arbitration if a union that's won an election has not been able to achieve a contract with the employer within 90 days. So that stalling mechanism now no longer works, because the only reason you stalled in the past was to avoid the contract. Now you'll have a contract. Maybe they might still stall to that first contract arbitration if they think they can get more favorable terms from the arbitrators than they could by giving into the union. But that's certainly much better. At least we've raised the floor from the current status quo of very rarely being able to achieve a contract at all. When talking about some of their other weapons, lockouts are now deemed an unfair labor practice if they are being used by the employer as a negotiating tactic. They can still lock out defensively if they think a strike is imminent or something similar, but they can now no longer do the bad faith move of offering a terrible contract, the employees don't want it, and then to try and impose the contract on them, the employer will lock them out. That's now an unfair labor practice. Really importantly, too, is throughout labor history, a lot of unions have been busted because the employer has been able to bargain to impasse on a bad contract and then unilaterally impose its final offer. The PRO Act also makes it an unfair labor practice for an employer to unilaterally alter terms and conditions after impasse. You can still reach impasse between the parties, but the employer has to maintain the terms and conditions that were previously in place during impasse. So no longer will it be able to unilaterally impose. Because I think that really defeats the whole purpose of bargaining. If one party is just able to get all of what it wants eventually, because it'll learn, and that's exactly what employees have done now over the years, is they've learned that if they just stall and stall and stall through bad faith tactics, they can get everything they want. And the PRO Act moves to defeat that. And it would repeal all state right-to-work laws, whether they're in a state constitution, whether it's just a simple bill that's been passed. No longer will states be allowed to pass laws that make it unlawful for a union and an employer to agree to a union security clause in a collective bargaining agreement, which is what a right-to-work clause does.
The PRO Act has passed the House. However, how in the world is it going to get through a Senate in which the filibuster is intact?
The filibuster intact, it can't. There is not 60 votes to pass the PRO Act under any conditions. You're not going to find 10 Republicans who are going to support one part of the bill, let alone the entire. So Democrats have to make a decision. They need to decide, are we going to get rid of the filibuster once for all, or at least reform it enough to the point of where the minority can't just permanently disbar any sort of debate on the bill unless 60 votes are found. We're looking at right now, but it is certainly the only path forward for labor law reform in this country. If you're trying to make it easier for unions to organize in a legal sense, has to be done through the Senate, and it has to be done through getting rid of the filibuster. I'll just restate what I think is important for the law. Is there's a lot of people on the left, a lot of progressives who debate with themselves, does organizing come before changing the law, or does changing the law predate organizing? Sort of a chicken and egg scenario, and I would say that both are important, both are necessary. I think you need to have some favorable legal terrain to make it easier to organize, but also the law will generally follow what unions are doing and social changes and things like that. But I will say, for people who reject altogether the legal approach, who say, oh, well, the law is just a reflection of power, and therefore there's no point in trying to waste resources trying to change the law, we should just go out and organize. I will say, my response to that is, and especially when looking at the Amazon election as an example, is that workers recognize power. They understand the law, even if they're not able to get out a legal book and point you to all the exact wording. When they see that the organizer has to stay on a little grassy knoll 100 yards away from the facility, and if he oversteps that by 1 foot, then security guards will be out there hauling them off to jail. Workers understand that that's power that the employer has, that it can exercise over them, impose its will. And that's just a reflection of the law. That's the employer being able to call upon the state to back up its position against unionization. And there needs to be legal changes under the law that make it easier for people to try and change that status quo, because workers understand, implicitly or explicitly, that the employer has tremendous power over their lives. And I think an approach that completely ignores what the law has to say and how it affects workers' minds is one that I think that is doomed to failure. And so while the PRO Act isn't in itself, I think, the silver bullet, I do think it makes it a lot easier for us to try and organize and restore the labor movement, in the same sense that the strike wave that we saw that predated the NLRA, which may have arguably brought the NLRA about, that strike wave was made much easier by the fact that the Norris LaGuardia Act repealed the ability of employers to go out and get injunctions against any strike that it wanted. People try to say that the NLRA, the law followed organizing. Well, in one sense, the organizing was made easier by the fact that employers couldn't just shut down any strike that they wanted. So that's the example maybe I'll leave with. We do need to change this broken law to make it easier for us to try and rebuild the labor movement and make it easier for workers to exercise their collective rights in this country, because currently it's an extremely difficult process where in most other countries it's not quite that difficult. Really, I hope anybody who cares about unions is trying to do something to support the passage of the PRO Act.
If the PRO Act was already law, Amazon wouldn't have been able to resort to its dirty anti-union tricks.
Brendan Magner, thanks for speaking with us.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.